This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Continuation of the episode on global English consumption. And in this one, I'm going to specifically look at a research topic with a very in-depth point of view. The research I'm going to be looking at is my own project, which involved using the Zaltman metaphor elicitation technique, which I've modified a little bit to be more suitable for this Taiwan environment. And we interviewed 16 people, and we can see their photographs that we used are on this page. And I'm going to post the paper, the draft of the paper at least, with some other photos included in it. And if you want to know how the ZMAT works, the procedure, I have a few links so you can see more detail about that. Basically, it's an in-depth psychological interview that ladders deeper and deeper until we uncover some motivations, in this case, related to English. Now, the reason I combine this topic with the English consumption one is that in the early to mid-90s, I spent a lot of my time working on language acquisition research. And then later in the late 90s, I was moving over more to marketing, and I was surprised by a lot of similarity there, that it seemed like a lot of the language market was about consumption, about a product, and that English itself was kind of a brand. And we talk a little bit about this in the language show, where we talk about Chinese translations to English and the research topic that goes with that. That you can actually think of English as a brand. And so this is a kind of marketing topic, but it's also a kind of language topic. So hang in there, bear with it if you're not a language researcher. You may find something interesting because this is looking at brands on a kind of sociological level inside society. You know, brands are not just the brands created by companies. Rather, companies are chasing these existing concepts to copy or imitate them to get their brand into people's minds, but people already have existing brands and thoughts. So I contact Dr. Paz Derrick in this episode, give him a phone call, and he has a great paper. If you get a chance, you want to take a look at it, and that's Recovering True Selves in the Electro-Spiritual Field of Universal Love, and that's in the Journal of Cultural Anthropology. And so I ran into Dr. Paz Derrick in the late 90s. We worked at the same university for a few years, and I think we had a lot of cross-fertilization on research. I was mostly in the statistics. He, of course, is anthropology and observation-based kind of description. And we shared a lot, and I learned a lot about a grounded theory, how to make better observations, how to combine my statistics with grounded observation. And I think he learned a lot about statistics, so we exchanged a lot of ideas. But more importantly, he was working on papers that really showed how inside society, in this case Taiwan, because he was doing all his research in Taiwan, economics and consumerism and even religion and spirituality are all combining together in a very localized way. And it's important to understand it from that local perspective. And of course, this show is all about that local perspective. So this show is very interesting. If you're not into language, hang in there. If you're not into marketing, hang in there. It's a combination of both. I think there's a payoff for everybody. So welcome. And
hey, here we are, Talk of Asian Marketing. And today's show is a research supplement where we follow up on a previous show, only now we have a lot more research detail. This would be for researchers, marketers, students. And today's show is even a little bit more on the sociological, maybe anthropological side. And we have a special guest, Dr. Nick Paz Derrick, who's teaching at University of Washington. And the reason he's a guest is he spent a lot of time in Taiwan, made a lot of observations, written some really good papers, including a paper published in the leading journal, SSCI ranked journal, with a great paper. Nick, what was the title of that paper you published?
Recovering True Selves in the Electro-Spiritual Field of Universal Love.
Universal Love. And that's a really great example, I think, because it's very localized observation. It involves a lot of different areas. And it's really amazing how you bring a lot of different things together in your work, in your observation. How many years
total have you been in Taiwan?
Thanks for the compliments. I can't really tell you how many years I've been in Taiwan, but the first time I came to Taiwan was 1989, and I can say that I lived most of my adult life in Taiwan.
That's the exact year I came, so I guess we were both here at the exact same time.
Right.
And in fact, we spent time together working at the same school for a while.
That's right.
So we've shared a lot of research ideas, I know, and we have a good knowledge of each other's work, and I have a lot of respect for your work. And so
Thanks.
I think that the reason I asked you on the show today is specifically we're talking about the consumption of English and kind of getting into it as a commodity, since this is a marketing show. And what's interesting is you've taken that perspective a little bit and looked at, you know, how is education a commodity in Taiwan? And specifically, I want to look at the concept of maybe, you know, post-export economy time. We're talking post-70s and 80s, getting into the later 90s, where we really saw changes. I was talking to Michael Turton the other day, and he kind of had that observation. Early 90s and late 90s seemed to have a big difference in the consumption attitude and then vis-a-vis education. What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's fairly clear. I don't really know how you would align this with numbers, but education is a manufactured product in Taiwan, and it's something that people consume, and it's a large portion of the economy, and there's a lot of people out there that we know, I think in the past, you know, when we first came to Taiwan or before, who would have lined up jobs in the export sector find themselves now, you know, circling through the cram school education system, sort of like, I guess, ladies in waiting or something for the future, something to happen, something to open up, to build up their equity in themselves, so to speak, and make themselves a more valuable commodity. And I'm not really sure that it works out every time, but at least in the process, they're consuming education in that part of the economy.
Well, Michael was talking the other day about that, I think, an important part of that cycling or that kind of being in the hold pattern while you're waiting to get a job is, of course, the cram school, the bushibun sector, which is really big.
Right. And it also includes the university sector. I think there's lots of MA Master of Science programs and MBA programs out there that people are, you know, they're marketed everywhere. Every university has to have them, and there seems to be a big market for that. And a lot of people lined up to take those kind of to pay tuition to be a student, to have a better future, to get more certificates, and somehow to develop a credibility so they can get a kind of job. And I really don't know how that works exactly for them, whether they all succeed or not. In fact, I don't really think they do. I think it becomes a kind of trap, you know. But that's the state of the economy in Taiwan. And there's specialized sectors that are doing really well, but then there's whole segments of the society that are just sort of scuffling along.
So you don't really see any big distinction then between the private sector of the cram schools and then the universities? They're both selling a very similar product?
I think that's the way it's evolved, you know, and it's really kind of sad. And I don't think that's necessarily how people would really like it to be, but there's a number of different kinds of pressures that have put it in that position. One is just a general consumer culture overall that's developed in Taiwan. You know, I mean, you just have people marketed to 24 hours a day, as you do in any country, including the United States, and, you know, parents who are busy working or consuming themselves, and you know, kids growing up in that consumer culture since the time we first came here. And when Taiwan was kind of a different kind of place where people were much more actively involved in production itself, consuming was something really, really exciting and different, and not everybody had access to it. And now it's widespread, ubiquitous, safe and easy, I guess. And nobody, you know, really expects to have what they want when they want it. And, of course, you know, they've come to accept that they can't have jobs, but they expect to have, you know, teachers be consumable, and they expect to have teaching materials that are consumable. And universities, although they're under pressure from the Ministry of Education to deliver, scientific research and high quality students capable of launching Taiwan into the 21st century or beyond. Are faced with hordes of trying to entice hordes of consumer oriented young people to participate in their programs so they can run the schools.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest change I've seen in Taiwan in general is that consumer orientation, and now it's just leaked over into the university. So that's why I undertook this research project, which is a continuation of previous work, which looks at, what are the real underlying psychological preferences or underlying motivators for people who are going to be consuming this English product, either at a bushiban, a cram school, or at a university. And of course, if we look at Western theory on teaching, especially second language acquisition, we get bombarded with a lot of stuff. And Nick, from teaching here, you get a lot of those materials and books that are all about, conversations and having fun and going out and having a social life, that kind of joining that kind of culture, a second language acquisition approach, which to me always kind of ran up against a brick wall real fast, more so lately than previously, because I don't see my students very interested in that at all.
Well, they are interested, but they want to do it in the local language. They already have a pleasurable, circle of people with whom they communicate on a daily basis. Why would they be? Why are they so compelled to go outside of that? And fewer and fewer Taiwanese feel compelled to go outside of that.
What a great point! That's really a great point you make, and I think that flies right in the face of a lot of popular culture assumptions, like the world is flat idea.
Yeah, well, I think you can. I mean, conversation itself is enjoyable. It requires a whole set of skills, right? It requires mental and it requires physical and in general social skills to be able to communicate and make it more difficult with language. And people can be quite inventive with their own languages and have a lot of fun. Enjoy themselves, and you see that all the time. You go to any tea house or coffee house, and you see people talking, and they're not talking in English. They're talking in either Taiwanese or Chinese, and they're having a lot of fun. And that's, I don't think, necessarily bad, and necessarily consumerism itself. It's human nature, I think, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to communicate with each other. But there's certainly the pressing need to be able to reach out to the so-called rest of the world is felt, but. It's a minor, almost inconvenience for a lot of people. They spend most of their time carrying on with people in Taiwan, and then every once in a while they have to reckon with a foreign presence, and unless their job is involved with foreigners on a day-to-day basis, in which case they can still get by on a very elementary level of English, because they just have to do trade and. Bill of ladings and on and on, the sort of thing that you might have to do to type in a customs form or negotiate a price or something of that sort. There's really no need to be that skilled and that gifted in foreign language, and certainly not to the point where it becomes a witty, inventive, engaging, experience of pleasure with the foreign other.
Yeah, that kind of internalized, that we always hear about, that internalized motivation where you do it because you really like to do it. And my research has basically found we can't find that.
Yeah, well, it doesn't surprise me. I think that you've hit a nail on the head, and you've done something that, as far as I can understand, that I've never seen. And I've looked at, I'm not an expert in the field, but all my students were doing, a lot of my students, anyway, graduate students especially, were doing stuff about second language research, and they were always talking. All the papers they were talking about motivation and getting people interested in culture and things. And I think also having taught culture classes, people are ambivalent towards other cultures. And I think this is true even in the West or wherever, Seattle. People like difference to a point, but they don't want it too much different. You go to a Chinese restaurant in Seattle, there are some Chinese restaurants that are really Chinese, but they serve only Chinese people, And you have a restaurant that sort of tastes like Western food, but sort of has a Chinese ambiance. Well, then that serves a lot of Western people, and you know, and the Chinese owners make a lot of money, and they serve really highly sugared food. It doesn't really taste like Chinese food. Nobody goes there, but, you know, they succeed in this market.
Yeah, well, I guess a good parallel would be Japanese things in Taiwan. There's certainly a big following of Japanese stuff, but right. It only goes up to a certain point, right?
Right, yeah. I mean, I've been into Japanese restaurants in Taiwan that are kind of close to what a Japanese restaurant in Japan like, but they still miss it, you know, by a long way. But that's okay, because people in Taiwan are, they're not, doesn't bother people in Taiwan, except, you know, people who travel to Japan regularly or really enjoy that, in which case they would just go to Japan to experience it. They don't have to stay in Taichung. And, you know, I think you're looking at a minority of people who want to reach out to the rest of the world and find connection with people who are different. And, you know, the assumption that everybody's going to want to reach out is sort of false. But then also the fact that the people are going to want to reach out to a certain kind of people that you see the culture presented in you know, the standard English language training materials are, you know, it's a sort of middle class, upper middle class, American, North American, maybe, world. And, you know, even that is a limited sector of this, of American society, right?
We're talking. Yeah, that's a funny point. I was just talking to a previous student of mine, Darcy, who's teaching over at Fengjiao University, and he was laughing at this. You know, he has a textbook with a CD video and audio, and it's showing a Japanese student who's supposed to be studying in America. He says, but obviously she's second generation. She speaks perfect English. And he says, you can't even find people who speak, you know, you cannot find a group of people that all speak this kind of perfect English anymore anyway.
Right, I don't know where they exist, and so that is, it gives a false impression, and it really doesn't give. And then, but then, what I think you're selling a false impression. You're giving people that what they want, and maybe that's what's sellable, and that's what people can buy. But then, because like I said to begin with, culture, people are ambivalent towards it. They don't necessarily want the real thing. You know, to face off with the reality of American life is to come to grips with the reality of human beings, which is not always so pleasant in itself. You know, there's lots of things that are really startling about, you know, day-to-day life in any place. You know?
Yeah, well, that's in my paper that the draft, I'm going to put it on the website. That's a line I use. It's, you know, you got these textbooks and you have this American life or this Western life, and it's free of insurance problems. It's free of living expense problems. It's free of all housing market declines. That's, they don't exist.
It's free of small business owners who have a chip on their shoulder. You know, a lot of people with, yeah, a lot more, yeah, exactly, on and on. Yeah, all the things I've been thinking about, you know, experiencing here recently, sure, yeah. You know, there's lots of good things to say about any given society, and societies sell themselves, and their branding, you know, they try to sell themselves through their, they try to sell some aspect of their society to the rest of the world, but that's just a commodity itself. You know, Taiwan tries to sell itself as what? I'm not sure. The green Silicon Island at one level, and I'm not sure. It used to try to sell itself as the true China, but it really can't do that anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of gotten stuck on that one. But anyway, you know, the underlying psychological motivations, I think we've kind of destroyed this idea that there's a lot of people out there in Taiwan or even Hong Kong that are, you know, just looking for that experience itself. And it's really hard. You know, I always use this analogy of, you know, what would happen if in America you had to require everyone to study Chinese? It was a requirement. How many people would like it? And how many people would want to read for pleasure? And how many people would be motivated when you say things like, you should learn this Chinese conversation because it will make you feel good. You should learn it because it will work for you internally, you know, this intrinsic motivator. If we made everyone in America study Chinese, I don't think that would work.
Well, I have my only personal experience with movement. You and I have both been hearing this our entire adult life, basically, that the future is Chinese. We're running into the Chinese century. At least that was a big thing when I was an undergraduate. I'm sure it was for you. And I took my Chinese classes as an undergraduate, and you start off with 100 people in first year Chinese. By the time you're in fourth year Chinese, you've got 8 people, you know. That's it.
That's it. Big drop-off, yeah.
A huge drop-off. And all the 8 people are all super hardcore, you know, and it's feeling miserable all the time because you're reading things that don't make sense, and you're wondering what kind of gain you're really getting off of it. Because when you go to speak the real Chinese, you know, the conversation quickly gets over your head, despite all of the vocabulary you learned, despite all of the short stories you've read.
So it's just really hard. It's a big challenge.
It's a huge challenge. You know, to break through the culture barriers takes, you know, like you and I both know, it takes a lot of time, you know, maybe most of one's adult life.
And I was going to say, I'm just in the middle of it now.
Right, here you are. And you know, this is something that I think people kind of figure this out eventually. You know, if they're not going to gain, they come to two conclusions. One, either they're not going to gain in the system in Taiwan because they can't produce English on tests as well as the majority of students, or they're always falling behind for some reason or another. They lose interest. And second of all, they realize, you know, even if they did, what would they gain? Right? Even if they were to become fluent in English, what would be there for them? There's just a minority of people who are really, really, really interested in getting out and you know, finding others wherever they may be.
Yeah, right. And I think it's a good point. So what we wanted to do is, I want to get at the core psychological motivators that are underlying this and try to peel away a lot of the fantasy. Of course, we can have an experiment. Nick, mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen papers like this. We can take a group of people and put them in a test group and take another group, put them in a control group. And in the test group, right. We can find people that have slightly more internalized motivation. Maybe we can talk to them about, you know, wouldn't it be cool to be a skateboarder in Seattle or something? And maybe these guys are English majors, so they have a motivator already. And then we can compare these groups. And of course, people who are more internally motivated, you know, are going to do better. There's no doubt about that. But I think my research is more aimed at, okay, if that may be true, but what about the majority of the rest of the people who are not artificially put into this kind of testing environment for this experiment? What are the motivators for the general population in Taiwan? And I think it also applies to Hong Kong in the future in China. You have these huge numbers of people. Is it realistic to say things like, you guys should all read for pleasure, read English for pleasure, when the most popular books are Harry Potter in Chinese?
Right. Well, there's a good point about that too. Is that we're looking at China even right now in Guangdong Province. They're making it's a conscientious decision to close down on a lot of small, medium sized factories. I mean that sector of the economy itself been shifted out to China is now being shifted away from China itself, and you've got to wonder, you know, even how many people are going to have an interest in learning English to do business at the level of that has been there in the past. So yeah, sure, I think it's a question that you could take across the board, take across the border, across the straits into Hong Kong, into China, no doubt about it. And what gets people interested? You also have to take into consideration that there are a small minority of people who are really gifted at learning second languages and enjoy it, right? There's always these people who are like, you know, they learn six or seven languages in their lives and they're pretty good at all of them. You know, there's a small group of people like that, but again, you're not talking about the majority. You're talking about people who somehow have a gift for learning languages, like some people have a gift for learning different musical instruments or something of the sort. But what would make, you know, the hoi polloi, the run of the mill person in Taiwan, you know, want to really squeeze the last juice, bit of brain juice, as they say in Taiwan, out for their English test? I don't know, you know, only to get to the next level in the testing hierarchy or something of the sort. I don't see them as having a big hope to connect up with the rest of the world through English, especially, as you say, when they can connect up the English, the world through, you know, Chinese materials that have already been translated by people who are really good at languages to begin with, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think that your observation, I mean, a lot of my research just lines up with the observation we have on the ground living here for a long period of time. And so I use the ZMAT approach, which you're a little bit familiar with, the Zaltman metaphor elicitation technique. And we began with a story at the beginning, which is you go to the post office and you run into an old high school friend. We're all talking to adults mostly. So you run into an old high school friend. And of course, you know, Nick, high school friends or high school classmates, that's an important concept in Chinese. And he says, his English is really good, and dot, dot, dot. That's all there is to it. And this sets off a kind of series of thoughts, and then we give them a camera to take away with them for a week or so. They take random pictures here and there, and then we bring them back for an extended interview. And on my website, you can see the exact process of the interview, but it gets deeper and deeper into the psychological aspects. And then we came up with basically representative photos that kind of, what does English mean to these guys, or what does it mean when their friend says their English is really good? And, no small number of people came back saying it's just straight out success.
Right.
And then
this is crucial.
Yeah,
right.
This is crucial. And then there's one or two people who were very clear it's success on test.
Right.
So you have a bunch of photographs.
I've always wondered when I hear about your Zaltman results that you may actually put people into a depression through your kind of research, because asking that question is basically telling, putting them in a position of being a failure,
Question
a lot of people don't want to answer, I have a few friends that are doing a lot better than I am, and they're professors at such and such universities and the Ivy League schools, and they have to face that, so it's not something I don't affect myself, but the other people, for a lot of people, in Taiwan, that's a big question, right? I mean, your classmates succeeding, why? Because they're good in English, and why were they good in English? I don't know. Maybe they scored 10 points higher than them always on the exams for 5 years while they were in school together, and they're just good at it for some reason, and off they go, their classmates are just, are stuck back in Taiwan, and their friends are jet setting around, which is supposed to be the successful life, but and everything, but you even if you're a failure, you can still get together with your friends and crack watermelon seeds and pour some tea and chat or do the things people in Taiwan like to do to have fun I'm a loser, I'm not so successful as my friend, and
what's interesting, you do that. I mean, so your experience, I mean, just talking to you and bringing this up and your point you make shows that your experience with your students living in Taiwan, automatically when you bring up the topic of English, it's almost immediately a competitive issue.
Wow, yeah, definitely. And people who are good in English are quite proud of it. And then the people who are not good in English express a typical feeling towards those who are successful. They're ambivalent. They're full of admiration, but at the same time they're full of disdain.
Yeah, right. Well, in our interviews, we talked, we had deep interviews with 16 different people, including from college students up to people in their 50s and a little bit older, late 50s. And so we came up with four big classifications of concepts that came out. And one was, I think, a little bit what we're just now talking about, and that is negotiated meaning, we call it. And that's like, they're not really sure if it's good or not good. Just kind of what you were just saying, do you really want to go overseas? Do you really want to join this other culture? What is this other culture anyway? Who are these foreigners? For example, when they talk about teachers, the foreign teachers are good, but they don't really understand what I want, this kind of thing. So negotiated meaning is really something that struck people deeply. But the other ones, I think, are more clear locally, and that is information. English is a way to get information from the internet, from books. Another one is achievement. Anyone who's good at English seems to achieve stuff, and they do this through cram schools, through tests, through getting better jobs. And then a big one that really seems to be deep and meaningful is mobility. And it's not just meaning mobility, get on the train or get on the airplane and go overseas, but rather it means getting somewhere in your society. And so these were the motivators for people, and there was nothing in there about being friends with somebody from overseas, talking to someone, or becoming more westernized.
I think for some people, being able to talk with Westerners is sort of like having a nice glass of wine, being able to afford a nice bottle of wine. It's an extra. You don't go into being, a doctor or something just to buy a bottle of wine. People I know who can speak English, who are really good in their professions in Taiwan, they don't speak English because they want to speak to me necessarily. They enjoy it, but they learn it because they had to. To be a doctor in Taiwan, for example, you should be able to speak English because you have to learn all those terms, because a lot of everything in the medical field is internationalized. You have to be tuned in at that level, but that doesn't mean that they're learning it to to be able to converse with me or even to serve me if I come in as a patient.
You know? Oh, that's a great example. So their English skill has been built up over that time, but it was all integrated into their goal of maybe social mobility or achievement, and then that's a byproduct of it.
Right. And, you know, they enjoy it, and they really think it's great. And, I meet a lot of friends who want to, to move outward from where they're at, but I don't think that was the motivation ever to start their life in that direction.
Yeah, right. That's a good point.
They were headed in that direction from the beginning, and they can speak extra. And there's a whole other class of people, I think, that just their parents just expect them to be able to move in multiple cultures. But that's a minority of, you're looking at people whose parents are doctors, whose parents are professors or lawyers or those kinds of upper middle class.
Yeah, Michael was kind of mentioning that. He was kind of thinking of it as a split society, kind of that M society idea from Japan, but I think it's a real, real small group.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's small, yeah, but it's big enough to be, to support several, international schools in Taichung, where you're calling from now, and... And the kids that, for example, my wife was involved with this is in administrative capacity, the kids that were in her schools and they're, 9, 10, 11 years old, their English is much better than the students at university I was teaching at.
Yeah, well, that reminds me. I was talking to one of the professors in my department in Taichung, and her daughter was walking with her, and I was mentioning my research. And I, was saying that this idea of having fun and this motivation, which is so important, this intrinsic motivator, so important in Western theory, just doesn't come up in Taiwan. And she's like, no, it does. And her daughter was standing right there. And I said, I looked right at her daughter and I said, well, why do you learn English? And her daughter goes to one of these private schools. She even has a private foreign tutor. And the daughter really had this big question on her face, looked up at her mom, Chinese children do not answer questions easily about these kinds of topics without parental permission.
Right.
And mom said, that's okay, go ahead, say what you think. And she said, because it makes my mom happy.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about that. I can't imagine, the average 10-year-old wanting to, spend their life learning multiple languages at a really high level, being able to do math and science and the whole course load in both languages without having... serious parental backing. But that, it all goes back to ultimately you can take this traces back, and I think this is certainly an issue that most language theorists, especially people in TESOL, don't ever, unaddressed question, and that is learning language itself is from the very beginning is a difficult process. And Freud never ceased to comment on how mankind could subject itself to the letter, to make itself, something that would sort of become subject to, typewriting, writing, words written in pages and all. And although reading does become pleasurable, but to learn to write and to learn to read, and it takes a lot of effort and it's kind of forgotten over the course of one's life. But I think, having kids, the stress it is to learn how to write. And this, even, think about all the grammar rules that you sort of know or sort of don't know. And I think anybody who thinks about learning languages itself is thinking, okay, maybe it is natural. Maybe Chomsky's right. Learning language is natural, at least verbally. But writing is a different thing altogether.
Yeah, I was thinking that something you said before that really struck me was that all languages are a form of inflicting violence on the learner. And I think someone
right.
like Pennington would be saying, when you take English overseas and you're forcing other people to learn it, it's going to be this kind of violent situation. But you said it always is.
It always is. And I think, Jacques Derrida, one of the most well-known philosophers of the 20th century, said that in a book called about monolingualism, where he was talking about being from Algeria and being Jewish and also speaking French as his first language, and talking about some of the questions involved in that, saying that all language is a foreign language ultimately. I mean, I have a 2-year-old and she's babbling all the time. She's not babbling in English, but eventually she will be because we're going to force her to. And I don't say that it's necessarily bad. That's how human society carries on, but it's something that people in TESOL forget. They don't think that you know, no one ever goes and says, well, listen, in our Tesla class, we're going to force these children to memorize 50 words, because if they don't memorize 50 words, then they can't learn 50 more words, which they need to be able to do this, and so on and so forth. Well, which is really, it's unspoken, but in fact true, that if you're going to be competent in language, you're going to have to force your brain to learn a lot of many vocabularies. And it's daunting intellectually, and some people probably can't do it. And it's also, it's time-consuming. Maybe people don't have time for it. It certainly requires a culture at home to support it. And you know, thirdly, you know, it just plain hard. And maybe people just get lazy, you know, especially when there's pleasures to be had elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly. So in this context, if you're in a market like Taiwan and you're looking at language learning, it seems to me that from my research and everything you've said and the paper you've been working on, I think that, you know, we come to the point where this idea of an intrinsic motivator just isn't there, or what is being internalized are these motivators such as social mobility, achievement, maybe getting some access to information that can assist that. And when it comes to really dealing with those foreigners, with that culture, with that American or Western stuff, that's really, really highly negotiated stuff. It's like nobody's quite sure what it means. And one of my favorite pictures out of our research is one of our older respondents. He just took a picture of a fire hydrant, Nick, and I thought it was so interesting because he said, English to me is like a fire hydrant. It was actually a fire extinguisher. So it's this big red bottle. And he says, you know, it's something you got to do, but you never use it until there's an emergency.
Yeah, right. And I think for a lot of people in Taiwan, you know, to confront the foreign other is something of an emergency situation. I don't know if you feel the same way. There's an alarm in their mind. Oh, my God, I'm supposed to be able to communicate here. I've been learning this since I was 12 years old.
Exactly. That's the beauty of this kind of ZMAT approach, is that it brings out these really deeper meanings. And I think he was taking the picture kind of more literal. Look, it's this thing that I don't use all the time, but once in a while I do. But you and I can look at it and say, yeah, right, we understand. When you run into that situation, it's a fear situation. It's just like being in a fire, and that tells a lot about this so-called motivator. You know, it's not really that positive, and it's not really that intrinsic towards that, you know, I'm doing it to be happy thing. Rather, it's a fire.
Right, and I also think some of this research about looking at, you know, whether, you know, kids being free reading, and I mean, I've had students in the university I was teaching at in Taiwan where we taught together, you know, who couldn't really read very well, you know, telling me that they would read much better if they were allowed to do free reading, because the free reading theory has penetrated so much of, you know, of teaching second language theoretical consciousness in Taiwan that even, you know, students are telling me that I shouldn't, you know, assign, you know, Catcher in the Rye or something for them to read, because they can read on their own, whatever, what it might be, Playboy magazine for all I know, but they would do much better. But the point on that is that I would even take that back further. And if you look at Chinese, you know, I always ask this question too, would Chinese students be allowed to, you know, Chinese students themselves, students of Chinese, Taiwanese students who are learning Chinese, would they be encouraged to free read themselves into being fluent in Chinese? And the question, the answer has got to be no, because you couldn't be able to read Chinese without having all the characters memorized that you have to have to begin.
Yeah, I think by the time you enter junior high school, your first year of junior high school, we're talking about something like 10,000 to 11,000 words memorized.
Right. And there's no way you can learn it without having, you know, basically being forced through every day, 5 days a week, an education program to be able to memorize those words, and also being in an environment where people use those languages all the time. And, you know, to think about, you know, English and free reading, it seems really naive considering how difficult it is to get to that point. And I think there's another point about this, too, that the research that I've seen, like, for example, in Freakonomics, they talk about, you know, what are some of the factors that precipitate or predict early childhood success in grade school. And, you know, the things like parents reading to children are not highly predictive. The highest predictor was, you know, does the family have books in the house? Well, and also is the family have a high socioeconomic status? So I think what we get is a kind of confusion of class versus a kind of confusion on this issue of class. Because, yes, the parents who are themselves highly literate and highly skilled with language, chances are their kids are going to be that way. Whether it's maybe it's partly genetic, and no doubt it's also in a major part of it is environmental. This is what all the research in this area says to us. But it's not necessarily because they're free readers. It's because that world that their parents live in, that's the world their parents has created for their children, is a world in which these things are valued, in which these things are encouraged, allowed, when the parents are taking part of it every day, and so on and so forth. It has nothing to do with like creating intrinsic motivation. It is just the world they live in.
Yeah,
and I think
right.
Sometimes the theorists in Taiwan get prescriptive and the descriptive confused. And the prescriptive is we would like everybody in Taiwan to live in upper middle class world where your parents had a library of books and musical instruments and a minivan and could create an environment where the kids could learn multiple languages, could learn to read, could feel free to be that kind of person. But in fact, that's just not the way it is. The society as a whole is like in America. You have TV as the center of the culture for people, family life as the center of culture for people, and reading and things aren't there. And to say that if people were allowed to free read, it would be better, I think it's for people who actually would need to memorize a lot of vocabulary. You're cheating them, and you're saying, "Okay, we can give you that home environment, that class culture on the cheap." Well, okay, I think it's right to allow those kids and those parents to think, "Okay, we can begin to set up that kind of class culture," which is what I think our old friend from California sort of gets people thinking about. But I forget his name.
Let's not mention it here.
Okay, right, but. in fact, this is not where most people are at, right? Most people are not in upper middle class families.
Well, I think the best point you had was that, you get this carryover. So if we looked at what the Chinese education's norms are, it's just so unrealistic to expect all those norms thrown away. And like you say, for a prescriptive, approach, that is, yes, of course, we can do some tests and we find out that the mouse can run through the cage faster when you do things this way. But the cage is not set up that way in the reality. And so to have people come over from their Chinese learning environment and then all of a sudden in English you're going to say something like, oh, this is supposed to be because you like it, I think is just unrealistic. And that's where the market is at. You have a cram school market, a university market, and even to some extent a high school market that is totally oriented towards the realities that come out of that Chinese education system, which is test orientation, achievement, and ultimately that all leads to social mobility.
Right. I mean, I think that's true, and people want that, but they want the social mobility but even that becomes very difficult for people to define. I mean, as you say in those VMAT images you get for people who aren't really successful, what does social mobility mean? Driving down the road in a new car? I mean, I don't really know.
One of the things that come across strong in our pictures is their children. So it seems like a lot of people put this on their children, that they want to have mobility for their children, and therefore they push their children to study that English, and that goes to cram schools or tutors or buying products like that. And so that's, I think that's, I'm not arguing that it's real. And of course, what I'm doing is descriptive totally. But yeah, it does seem that the children's idea is really strong. My children need that opportunity. English is part of that, a key to open that door.
Right. And this is the sad thing, because basically they end up being consumers. Right. I know many parents, or I should say, I know enough parents to say that. They spend a lot of money to send their kids to schools like my own and expect their kids to be able to speak when they get out, and they can't. And they've been cheated along the way. They've been fed this intrinsic motivation. Teachers are all, and at the same time they take a consumer attitude to class, and teachers feed them what they want, which is, you know, a sweet talking, happy, you know, American, you know, jovial, clown-like approach. And in the end, they're no better off than they were when they graduated from junior high school, really. And
which is probably where they got the biggest boost in their skill base to start with.
Right, they went from 0 to 50 at least, and. You know, I'm sure there are studies that say that if the kids just redid junior high school or high school, they'd probably be a lot better off than they ever would if they went to high school or you know, to university or cram school for that matter.
Yeah, right.
And, cause you can learn a ton in Chinese high school, certainly enough to be able to do business in English. And there's no reason to go to high school. There's no reason to go to university and study English for that purpose, I think, you know.
Well, I think the whole university system has been sucked down on this intrinsic motivation theory, and it just gets to be very, very tricky, because you and I have both been there. We've been in the university setting in time when we've seen it. And, you know, there's just a constant self-loathing on the part of students and teachers saying, why isn't this working? You're supposed to, you know, teachers are always saying, you're supposed to like it, why don't you? And students come out saying, what happened? I didn't improve at all. And then
they're in the process. They're enjoying. They think it's all fun. You know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say when they finish, they go to take the exams, and all of a sudden they find out, you know, they don't pass the GEPT, or they don't get high enough to get a job, and this is all, you know, a big disappointment to them.
Yeah, it's obviously it's tragic and also a scam. And it's disappointing. I think there's people in Taiwan who could reason through this and think better, but they feel like it's sort of semi-corrupt. You know, the universities, for example, they and people who run the universities, you know, must know that education is not easy. But you know, in order to maintain the bottom line, you know, maintain the profit figures, which can be quite substantial for these schools. You know, to be able to pay off the debts to the...
Well, not only that, I mean, they can try to actually get into the cram schools market also. So it's kind of overlapping. You have the cram schools and the universities, and they're all working, you know, to grab the same market. So when you're in an English department, or what we have here in Taiwan, applied foreign language departments, in many ways they're competing with the cram schools, and they want to offer the same opportunity. And cram schools, it's popular. You just pay, walk in whenever you want to, drop into any class, no special material to prepare or anything. And I feel there's a lot of that going on in the Inyonghwai, the applied foreign language departments in Taiwan. You know, it's just the idea you just drop in, entertain yourself for a while, and somehow that's going to get your intrinsic motivator going. So I think in the ZMAT research, although we're not looking at a product, and ZMAT's made to look at brands, I adopted the idea that English is a brand. And what I ended up finding out was that for most people, what they see in this brand, or the benefit of this brand, or the way they perceive this brand, are these things like achieving something, getting social mobility, maybe obtaining some information. But when it comes to really liking it or being drawn towards it, a very, very big question mark. And that includes people who we interviewed. We had one or two people who were even very closely linked with a native speaker. One was divorced from a native speaker. And there were very, very mixed feelings about that, you know. But always their children, the idea was, we need this to get them ahead. And I think as a creator of materials or someone entering this market, I think you need to get away from the fantasy and look at the reality, which is, people want to get something locally for this. They don't want to get something globally for it.
Well, if they want to get something globally for it, it's an upgrade in the local standard of living of some sort in general, you know, approach something more like a, you know, the Western consumer life has been pretty much obtained in Taiwan as far as possible, as far as I can see, you know. It's within that confines of that small area, you know. But, I think you're 100% correct. I don't see how I see you're 100% correct, and as I say, it's disturbing, and it points out a number of the weaknesses in the system in Taiwan, and it points out weaknesses in the theories about you know, language teaching training, and also the way that you know, a whole set of researchers treat places like Taiwan, you know. And I think this has, of course, been pointed out by people like you said, like Penny Cook and others, you know, sort of critical linguistics on these issues, looking historically into the present. So okay. I think your research is really fantastic in this area, and I think it's I wish that everybody could take that kind of critical perspective on English training, and I wonder what would happen if they did. That would always be a sort of interesting mental experiment.
I think it's hard. The predisposition is just so self-serving. I mean, it's self-serving, first of all, from the Western perspective, where you export right. this idea of the self, and then the other should become more like us, you know.
Right.
You guys should be like us. And then a lot of local researchers buy right into it. And I remember going to a conference once, I think this really tells it all. I went to a conference yeah. and a woman was talking about her survey results, and she just gave survey questions, and it was a scale 1 to 5, and you and I both know statistically, you know, this is highly questionable. What does a 5 mean, and what does a 3 really mean if you don't have comparisons? And she said that, you know, she asked her students about their previous English learning, and then she asked them how much they like English. And of course, she found out people who don't like English, they rated their previous teachers poorly. And people who do like English rated their previous teachers highly. And so she said, therefore, this proves students who don't like English, who don't have that intrinsic motivation, their motivation was ruined by their previous bad teachers.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's hilarious. It's totally backward logic.
Yeah, and then the students who did like them, they were encouraged. Therefore, we should all encourage our students and not ruin it. And I stood up and asked a question, and she got very angry at my question. I think, Nick, you can understand local researchers would get angry because they're just buying into a set of assumptions. They don't understand why. And I said, well, what about people who don't like math? I guess maybe since you teach an English department, you don't like math, and you know, Nick, it's very common for English teachers in Taiwan to say they hate math. And I say, now, did your math teachers ruin it for you? And she got very upset at that point. And my point being, you know, that's just totally backwards logic.
Right, yeah. Yeah, no, it's wonderful to be able to think, to be able to draw conclusions in that pattern, but it's only convenient when you want to establish the status quo, you know, reestablish the status quo. It doesn't have much to do with thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've had that experience too, teaching a large class of freshman English, which people are, they're not majors, and they're not supposed to necessarily be good at English, and you have a class and they score all poorly on a very easy test, and I ask them, so, well, you guys are really bad. I got this rapport going with them, and we're sort of going back and forth. So, guys, well, we're doing really bad, and you've been really bad for years, so what's the reason? I bet I know. Your teachers were all bad, right? And they all said, yeah, our teachers were all bad. You know, they've all learned that, right?
Yeah, it's so, just like an automatic response, right?
Right, and I think this is the self-loathing you talk about. So if you're, the Tesla research is also amazingly teacher-centered. You know, it's very narcissistic, and also leads easily to self-loathing.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why this my research goal, and I think a lot of research that you've done and you've written up, is to get away from those assumptions and just look at the reality, the local reality that's going on. And in this case, the local reality for language learning, if you're going to really market something successful, a good product, and I don't think most of the cram schools are good products, and I don't think most of the universities are, but if you want to get into this market, look at what people really want and try to supply that. Now, maybe that's something you don't think is valuable. Maybe helping people get a good score in the GEPT to you is not a universally good thing. But I'm not sure that, you know, people who want to learn English because they want to go have a date with some English-speaking person and buy pizza, I'm not sure that's any better.
No, I spent the previous seven years teaching in Taiwan, mostly cultural issues, and as an anthropologist trying to explain American culture through films and things. And I went home nearly every day, and I confess with the thought in my mind that if people weren't buying what I was selling, and they had no real interest in learning about culture at all. In fact, it was just, you know, worthless. You know, it varied from class to class, of course, and the intelligence of the students. But I think in general, there's an awful lot of people who would really care less about America or Canada or Australia, unless it fits their fantasy mold of what that place is,
yeah.
then they'll accept it.
Yeah, that's a good
unless
point.
Unless they can go there on a tour group with their own native speaking group.
And only visit places that fit their assumptions, yeah.
Right, right. In other words, and anything else outside of that, they really don't.
Yeah, and it works the other way, too. Of course, it works. I mean, I don't want to sound like we're being down on just the local culture here in Taiwan. It works every way for all cultures, right? You don't see Americans.
Yeah, like I said, when I took Chinese, and, you know, we've been bombarded with since we were starting in school. You and I, we took it seriously. But by the time I finished, you know, or by the time I got through my undergraduate training in Chinese, there were just a handful of us left. And you know, that you get up against that barrier, you know, really. You're an adult. You spend a whole life learning your own language to varying degrees of competence, and it's never easy. You know, even if you're a high-level researcher, you're going to send a paper out and it's going to have editorial marks all over it. And you know, to learn something like Chinese and every day feel yourself humiliated by the fact that you get a pronunciation wrong, you get a grammar point wrong, you draw a character wrong. You know, that takes. You know, you have to be really, really committed to it personally. And I think everybody, you know, from my own experience, that would be learning Chinese wouldn't be doing it because we're all curious about Chinese to a certain degree, but that wouldn't sustain our effort. By a certain point, all of us were pretty much committed to having some sort of a relationship with China for our careers.
Yeah, for the
how
job.
How different is that than exactly what you're saying? I mean, I think it's one and the same.
Yeah, I really do. You know, because my research is only being done on Chinese respondents, but I suspect it's like what you've said before, and that's why I think a lot of our research kind of integrates. I think mm-hmm. it's a universal phenomenon where you're just defining yourself, your own boundaries, by what the other people are not. And they're not like me, therefore there's something wrong, and my way is right. And, you know, it just carries over. And I'm surprised it's gone this far in TESOL theory and TESOL teaching practice. I mean, you just seem to see it everywhere, and it's sometimes very discouraging. I was at a conference once in Hawaii, and a teacher sat down at a bus stop next to me and said, you know, blah blah blah, I'm from so and so. And I said, oh, I'm from Taiwan teaching. I thought she'd be very interested, but she came back with very negative feelings right away, saying, well, can't you tell your students to cheat less? All my students that come from Taiwan, they cheat all the time. And I explained, I said, well, you know, in Chinese culture, you know, there's a lot of copying going on for learning Chinese. You know, Nick, that's
right.
Basically how Chinese is learned, is through repetition, repeating phrases and terms, and copying stories and writing. And she said, well, that's your job to teach them. And, you know, wow.
Yeah, but they don't really want to hear it. They don't want to be taught not to copy and cheat and things, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, if I came back and did what she said, I'd be let go very quickly, or my students would not learn it, or, I mean, it's just...
Or you would go home every day with the feeling that people weren't buying what you were selling.
Exactly, not buying what you're selling. And so on that final point, we'll wrap it up. I think the idea is localization. This is the idea of this website, of this podcast. We're always talking about localize. And in this case, using ZMAT to get into deep psychological constructs, metaphors that people relate to brands, or in this case, relate to a whole language, which is really a product, and understand those rather than imposing some kind of foreign view on it, especially a Western view, but any kind of view that you just think is true off the top of your head, or that you think worked for you and maybe didn't even work that way. So localize. I think you could agree with that, Nick.
Go out there and really try to understand the people that are being subject to your theories, and be surprised.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Nick, and good luck at your class at University of Washington. I hear you have good enrollment there.
Well, thanks. Thanks.
What's the title of that class you're going to be opening this semester?
Talking about universities, yes. Universities called Producing Power in... Power Knowledge, University and Critical Perspective.
Wow. That sounds like it's very related to the topic, and I know it's right up the alley of all your experience, and I wouldn't mind sitting in on your class, actually.
Well, all the research is similar. You know, universities are turning themselves into brands. That's the trend, you know. The universities themselves are becoming brands, and they're marketing all sorts of products outside of education and things of that sort. So
it sounds very similar to Taiwan.
About this. Yeah, a lot to be said on the subject.
Okay. All right, Nick, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, you're welcome. Anytime. My pleasure.
This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Meow, 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 meow.